A global survey says vaccine skepticism is worse in wealthier countries. Live from London, this is the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Anu Anand. Good morning. In New York in April, authorities declared a health emergency over measles, a disease so infectious it stays in the air for 2 hours and can lead to blindness, deafness and death. Right now, U.S. measles cases are at a 25-year high. And a global survey today confirms that it's wealthier, more developed countries where vaccine skepticism is highest. Charlie Weller is head of vaccines at the Wellcome Trust, which conducted the survey.
9 out of 10 parents globally said that they were getting their children vaccinated, and that's fantastic. But if you look at some countries and some people, they're much more sceptical and the vaccination rates are much lower. And this is where we need to focus our efforts.
So, for example, France was a country that had the least faith in vaccines. The US is also in there. And Eastern Europe, just 50% of people believe vaccines are safe. Is there any indication as to why?
I think one key element is the fact that we don't see polio, we don't see diphtheria, we don't see measles until very recently. And therefore, we kind of forget that they're an issue. We forget how devastating these diseases can be and how terrible they can be. And therefore, we become maybe a little bit complacent and forget how amazing vaccines are and the fact that vaccines have prevented so many diseases and impacted so many lives.
Do you think social media plays a role?
There is so much more information out there and there's so many different avenues that people can go to find this information. So we need to make sure that the information that's out there is accurate.
And there is a cost to all of this. Studies have estimated that it's thousands of dollars for a single case, depending on the circumstances. And in one case, $4 billion was the estimate for an outbreak in the worst case scenario. Vaccines, how much do they cost?
Much less. So the cost of a single vaccine, not just does a vaccine protect the individual, but it can protect the community. But also if you imagine that if you're ill, you're in hospital, you're suffering and your family's looking after you, that's a whole family that isn't working potentially. Each country, each community will have different drivers. And we know with hesitancy, this can be political, it can be cultural, it can be religious. There are many different reasons. So we need to understand more.
Charlie Weller. Let's do the numbers. Asian stocks rose as investors bet on a worldwide wave of central bank stimulus. Expectations are building that the US and Eurozone may deliver interest rate cuts as early as July. London's FTSE 100 is down 0.3%. Investors dumped airline stocks after a bearish note from HSBC. Now, hedge fund billionaire Stephen Schwarzman has donated $188 million to Oxford University in England, the biggest single gift in its history. It'll be used to set up an institute for ethics in artificial intelligence. Mr. Schwarzman is closely connected to the Trump administration and led its recently disbanded business forum. This morning on British radio, Louise Richardson, vice chancellor of Oxford University, was questioned about the connection between his money and his politics.
Do you really think we should turn down the biggest gift in modern times, which will enable hundreds of academics, thousands of students to do cutting-edge work in the humanities, by which I mean history, literature, music, the arts, all the things that give joy and meaning to our lives? We are a university. We, of course, have people with different points of view. Of course, we engage with people who have different politics than we do. That's what universities are all about. And again, just to focus on the scale of this gift, this will be transformative for future generations and for the city of Oxford.
Louise Richardson. Yesterday, authorities in Berlin outlined plans to freeze rents in the German capital for the next 5 years. But are legal limits on how much landlords charge the best way to bring down living costs? The BBC's Mike Johnson has been investigating.
Hi, Leanna. Hi, it's Mike from the BBC.
Leanna Etkind shows me round her one-bedroom apartment in South London.
This is my flat, little hallway, bathroom and shower.
34-year-old Leanna is one of the 2.5 million people who now rent privately in the British capital. For her, life as a London renter can be stressful and precarious.
Landlords definitely have the upper hand. They know that in most places in London, if they move you on, there's going to be like 10 or 20 people ready and willing to take that space.
In a previous apartment, Leanna was faced with an increase of almost 40% in her rent. She couldn't afford it and she was evicted. She now wants to see legal limits put on rent rises.
So generally in life, I have choices and I move my life ahead. But when it comes to where I live, I don't have any power.
Well, I can't go home because I haven't got a cent.
Plenty of countries already have some form of rent control, including France, Germany and Spain. So do big US cities like New York, Washington, Los Angeles and San Francisco. It might be a cap on rent rises within tenancies, so people like Leanna couldn't be forced out by huge increases. But is rent control really such a good idea?
Rent control causes shortages of housing. It causes housing to deteriorate.
Mark Joffe is from the Reason Foundation, a Los Angeles research group which favors free markets.
I grew up in New York, so for me, the experience with rent control is quite real. The landlord's income is limited, but at the same time, the landlord is almost certain to be able to get a tenant. So that means the landlord doesn't really have to invest in the quality of the apartment. By the 70s and 80s, it was really obvious that rent control was causing very serious problems in New York. It's the obvious thing to do, but it's economically not the right thing to do. The right thing to do is to allow developers to build enough capacity so that competition will bring prices down.
Mark Joffe there, ending that report by Mike Johnson. Finally, in Japan, there's a TV show about a woman who dares to leave the office at 6 p.m. sharp. I Will Not Work Overtime, period, depicts the struggles of the 30-something trying to achieve work-life balance in a country where overwork claimed nearly 200 lives in 2017. In London, I'm Anu Anand with the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.